Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Growth Axiom podcast. Today, I am very excited to have a special guest, and that person is Bizola. Bizola, welcome to the podcast.
Abel, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you, sir. Alrighty, let's get straight down to it. So for the people who would like to know a bit about you before we get into the meat and potatoes of today's episode, tell me a bit about yourself and how you got into the world of crypto, what you do, all that good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess my background is something of classic TradFi person being converted to crypto. So I spent a tiny bit of time at JP Morgan in the research division before spending the bulk of my career over at EY in consulting. And that was then when I really fell down the crypto rabbit hole. So I've been in the space for about 8 years at this point. And you know, when I got into the space, I was more interested in the kind of the technical aspects of the technology, but really struggled to get access to great information. And so I ended up starting this kind of research media publication to solve that problem for myself. And when we monetized, we started accepting payments, and then gradually fell down that rabbit hole in what was the inspiration behind Super, if that's helpful context.
It is indeed. I want to double tap into your experience of building a Web3 publication. First of all, what was the publication about? What did you do? You mentioned previously that you had to accept crypto payments, and I would assume that played a role in your understanding of the pain that exists when you try to accept crypto payments. So maybe talk to us a bit about that, your experience there, and how that informed your journey to build Super.
Yeah, so when I got involved in the space, I was more interested in the technology. So I wanted to understand how Merkle trees worked, how hashing algorithms worked. And back then, the other publications like CoinDesk, Cointelegraph, and The Block, they were more focused on producing content related to, you know, Bitcoin going up by 5%, Ethereum going down by 2%. The really deeply technical content was very challenging to get to. And so essentially, you know, the platform was the solution to that problem. And so like any other media publication, we tend to monetize via advertising. And it was in that kind of, you know, role where we're accepting crypto payments, fiat payments, but the core of the publication was really to be this kind of great resource for more technical content, essentially, which ended up growing very fast, actually. Yeah.
Awesome. Tell me a bit more about the scale that it managed to get to.
Yeah, I mean, we got up to, you know, millions of readers per year on a yearly basis. We scaled that company to six figures in annual revenue, then eventually sold the company when I wanted to really tackle this payment problem. And so that was the scale of that kind of bootstrap company. So that wasn't VC backed at all, totally bootstrapped, and it was a great experience, kind of building in crypto pretty early on. And now I think for us, it's about tackling a much larger problem around payments and trying to bring more people into the space and get more commerce flowing on chain, essentially.
So tell me a bit about the payments challenges you were having while building this publication that led you to build Super.
No, yeah, absolutely. So I think I alluded to the scale of the previous company. And so the challenge really originated from the idea that, look, we were accepting fiat payments using Stripe, crypto payments on chain, just to a wallet address or via Coinbase, perhaps. And as you're a fast-growing company, having that billing information or that payment data kind of living in two separate places becomes more operationally complex for you as an entity as you're scaling. It's not feasible to have such inefficiencies in that regard. But I would say fundamentally, that was more the symptom of the low-level problem or the root cause, you know, this kind of fragmentation of billing and payments data. The actual low-level issue is just the infrastructure for Web3 merchants to operate just didn't exist. Because they need a bunch of different tools surrounding that. So one is the payment acceptance, the other is the accounting, the other is the off-ramping, and all of that in one cohesive ecosystem or platform just didn't exist. And so the core problem that needs to be solved is this kind of lack of modular, extensible infrastructure around kind of Web3 merchants. That was really the pain that we were experiencing, and you know, the fragmentation of data was more the symptom, if that's helpful context.
That is indeed, yes. And so one thing that I would like to double tap into, because I think this is interesting in the context of, you know, building products in Web3, the infrastructure is constantly being improved. You know, as a good example, you experienced this problem while building the publication, and then you've gone ahead and actually built a fintech to solve that problem for yourself and then also other people. Something like Super, we had a very interesting conversation before this podcast where you mentioned something like Super couldn't exist 5 years ago. The infrastructure wouldn't have been there to enable something like this. So I wonder what exactly has changed between, you know, in the past couple of years in terms of infrastructure that has enabled something like Super to exist. You know, what is the why now? Because I think that's actually quite an interesting conversation to have.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I think there's a couple of kind of infrastructural pieces that are here today that makes this business, you know, a great time to build. So I think the first is just around kind of wallet infrastructure. You're seeing a lot of advancements in that area. That means from a developer's perspective, we can more easily move funds just via APIs, kind of wallet to wallets. And there are a bunch of great service providers and kind of startups building in this space that just make it easier for us to move money internally for our merchants if we need to. So that's the first key thing I would say. I think you also have this shift, and this is less infrastructure, but this shift in consumer behavior. You know, more consumers are paying our merchants via stablecoins. It sounds pretty obvious, but back when I was kind of really in the weeds of crypto, most people were transacting with the native cryptocurrency. They were transacting in, say, Bitcoin or ETH. It's quite ludicrous to be paying for things using this kind of volatile asset. And so when stablecoins like Circles, USDC, has seen such product market fit, now you're seeing more people just adopt it. And that's been a phenomenal change in behavior just for merchants, you know, how they accept, and more importantly, how they account for their payments. Because when you're accounting for a payment happening in ETH, that's very difficult because you have to get the cost basis. But when you're accounting for a payment in, say, USDC, that is much, much operationally simpler for the merchant. So that's been very important. I think third, I would say, is these kind of plaid for crypto solutions that are popping up that make it easier for kind of these businesses and consumers who hold the vast majority of their cryptocurrencies, for example, in exchanges, they allow you now to actually pay merchants from these exchanges. And so what's really happening is these APIs are instructing the movement of money from an exchange to paying the merchant, whereas before, it would have been much complicated for that to happen in the past. So I'll definitely say these three changes from wallet infrastructure, consumer behavior, and then lastly, these kind of plaid for crypto solutions instructing money movement, making it more easier, have all contributed to why now is a great time to be building in kind of crypto payments.
That's a phenomenal answer, and I completely agree with all of that. And I'm excited to see how the infrastructure continues to grow and support more interesting types of applications as things go on. Speaking of infrastructure, it seems like there's a whole world of, I guess, fintechs, you can call them, that are servicing crypto companies, you know, companies that are focusing on accounts reporting, that kind of stuff. And I know that there are various different niches. And for me, I'm not quite aware of all of them. And I wonder if maybe you could spend some time for us in the audience plotting out the landscape of what exists out there and, you know, perhaps maybe where there are some gaps for people to potentially look at and build products in. I'm very curious as someone who has a lot of knowledge on this in this area.
No, absolutely. I mean, we put out this kind of landscape on that we termed kind of Web3 and fintech, right? The idea is you have these crypto companies that have these kind of Web3 fintech like solutions servicing you know, on-chain organizations. And so, I mean, I can kind of send that link to you, Abel, but you have these different categories of companies from kind of tax to accounting and reporting to pure payments. And now you're even seeing kind of lending emerge as a category as well. So the core idea with these kind of fintechs companies is they look like the fintechs of the old past, like a Monzo or a Starling, but the customers that they serve is just different. And what's clear now is the classic Web2 fintechs, like a Ramp or a Brex, they are inadequate to service this kind of growing pie of on-chain organizations. And so what do? Well, you need to have Web3-specific companies or fintechs emerge to fill that need. And so that's what we're seeing a ton of, these kind of Web3 fintechs emerging to service and solve on-chain specific problems. And so I think for us, it's an exciting time to be building in that area. And a couple of those examples in terms of categories that we're watching is kind of tax, accounting, reporting, kind of lending now as well. You have FinOps. Of course, you have pure payments. And then you have off and on-ramping as well. And so those are the few areas that we're kind of watching in the kind of Web3 fintech niche. And happy to dive more deep into plays that we think are interesting, but that's kind of a high level that's helpful.
Yeah, I appreciate the high level landscape. And of course, we'll definitely link the resources that you mentioned in the podcast description for those who want to check it out. I kind of want to move to an area where, you know, you're building Super. There's obviously a landscape, and that landscape is growing day by day, new players entering the market. Where do you see yourself? Like, where do you see, you know, Bezola's company, Super, playing in that landscape right now and then also into the future as well? I'd love for you to paint that product vision for us.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And in that landscape, funnily enough, we put ourselves in our own category. but I mean, I think we're being facetious on some level. But the category we put ourselves in was kind of billing. The idea, you know, being kind of, you know, paying homage to the problem that I faced originally in the invoicing aspect of accepting crypto and fiat payments. That's what we want to do exceptionally well. And that's the category that we see ourselves playing in. So the idea of making it as simple as possible for these merchants to accept payments, and then we handle the entire billing infrastructure that kind of spins off. You know, billing can get pretty complex pretty fast because it's a kind of a nebulous term that not many people understand. But at a fundamental level, it relates to kind of issuing an invoice. A customer pays that invoice, and then there's an assessment of funds eventually as a result of that. And this kind of simple flow is what we're obsessed with at Super, essentially. We are obsessed with making that as efficient, as smooth, as fast as possible. And we're building kind of this set of infrastructure to surround that process of just kind of the merchant issuing an invoice in fiat, in crypto, and Super kind of enabling the movement of those funds from the customer to be as simple as possible. And so the billing category is where kind of Super sits today, if that's helpful.
That is helpful indeed. Thank you so much. And I love the idea that you guys are in your own category. I think that if you're building, you know, if you're building a product, you want to be a category creator. You know, it's a phenomenal place to be. So talk to me a bit about how you're planning. I want to know a bit about your product process, you know, like how do you decide what features to build? You obviously mentioned that you're obsessed with this flow at the moment. How much of the flow are you covering at the moment versus how much you want to cover in the future? Tell me a bit more about your product process, where you are right now with the product and where you want to go and how the product process will influence that into the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think our product process consists of a few different things. So the first is, like I alluded to earlier, is the fact that we are just focused on doing this one thing really well. And so we define Super as much as the things we choose not to do as the things we choose to do. And so we believe that this focus enables us to deliver insanely great products. And so much so that I suspect that, you know, we have one of the most superior kind of crypto invoicing B2B payments platform right now on the market. So that's kind of the first area is this kind of extreme fanatical, you know, focus. And then the second really relates to the emotional aspect of our product. So we spend, you know, a lot of time thinking about the emotional experience we want to recreate for our merchants. So look, when I'm onboarding a new customer and I see the joy, the thanks, the elation of kind of interacting with our software, we take that experience and or that emotional reaction and then work backwards to figure out how do we cultivate this product or craft this product to produce that emotional response. It's a very high bar to set. I acknowledge that, but it feels like what that enables us to do is we can build our product not only to meet the immediate needs of these merchants, but also build a little bit into the future as well to predict their needs and craft these experiences that they themselves didn't think was possible. And that's really important to us is, you know, our merchants are great. They give phenomenal feedback, but they don't know what is necessarily possible with technology. And so we want to craft that, build that to produce these moments of delight and elation for our merchants. And those two key points around focus and kind of the emotional needs is how we think about product here at Super, for sure.
That's amazing. And often what you find when you build a product, you have an initial thesis or an initial insight that you're looking to kind of have play out in the market. But then as you're enacting on that, you tend to find interesting insights or things that you thought, wow, I never would have thought this would have been how the market works, or I never would have thought this customer would have thought they wanted this or whatever, right? It could be whatever. It kind of depends on context. What is the most interesting insight you've uncovered through running this process and building Super as a product?
Yeah, I think the most interesting or surprising insight that we've seen is optionality, or merchants giving optionality to their customers in how they can pay. And that's really one of our core value props at Super, is that we integrate both fiat and crypto payment methods at the checkout. And so what that means is, if I'm a merchant and I want to accept crypto, well, I still want to give my customers the ability to pay in fiat or in crypto or some alternative payment method. And I think in kind of the crypto world that we live in, which is very, you know, on-chain or nothing, is important, because it's kind of the antithesis of that, because we are enabling value to move in both rails, not just crypto. I think that was a surprise learning, because the assumption is, you know, people just want to do things on chain, pay on chain, but that just doesn't kind of map to reality. Merchants want to give their customers flexibility. So that means that we have to have this blended approach to enabling value to move via fiat, crypto, and any other chain that comes.
That's awesome. And I want to dive a bit deeper into your experience building Super, in a sense that you've kindly put together this landscape, this Web3 fintech landscape. And so that must have given you a good understanding of what's out there. And maybe for those who are listening and are trying to build fintech products for Web3 in Web3, can you give them a good understanding of what it's like to build a Web2 fintech versus a Web3 fintech? What's different building a Web3 fintech? Because I imagine there's quite a few differences there, and I think it'd be interesting to uncover those.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think my answer to this is slightly nuanced, but it's bizarre slightly, because I think the biggest difference, at least that I've seen building kind of Web3 products versus Web2 products, is how much more you need to understand the history behind the space that you're building in. And so what I mean by that is, if you're building in kind of Web3 or say consumer lending or remittances, you actually need to understand the history of payments from the Web2 side as well, right? You need to understand, you know, where did Wise come from? Why did they grow so quickly? You know, where did these other kind of international payment products come from, and why have they grown so quickly? It's important to understand that, because the mistake that I've seen happen is Web3 builders assume that they are not competing with Web2 solutions, which is not true. customers, merchants, more than ever have optionality behind the products that they can use. And so what that means is you're competing not just with some other Web3 parent company, but you're also competing with Wise, for example. And so I think the need to understand the history of Web2 payments, to then figure out, okay, how can I leverage kind of blockchain, crypto technology to build a better outcome for our users, is something that I've learned, and I think a lot of people don't appreciate more of, but it is incredibly important to build really effective kind of Web3 fintech products. And so the end result of that is, well, the nature or the type of founder that ends up building what I consider to be great Web3 products is probably very different to the type of usual, I don't know, Web3 founder you might come across, right? So on the DeFi side, you get a lot of degens who, you know, I don't know, they're kind of shit posting, they're all, you know, trading as they're trying to build a bunch of other things that is not very, I would say, would not map cleanly to the idea of a Web2 founder, of a Web2 fintech founder. And I would definitely wager that the type of founder to build great Web3 products probably looks more like a Web2 fintech founder than like a Web3 DeFi degen founder. And that's just because of understanding the deep historical context and being able to appreciate how you just deliver 10x innovation where you want to just leverage new technology. And so I think that's the biggest difference that I've seen kind of Web3 founders versus Web2 in this context of kind of fintech.
I'm a big fan of the IDMAs that I believe either Balaji invented and Chris Dixon popularized, or vice versa. I can't remember. And for those who are interested, we'll pop that into the chat, into the description. But it kind of lines up with what you're saying there. I think understanding the historical context of the area you're playing in is a phenomenal way to be. If you want to build the future, learn history, right? You know, it's a phenomenal answer. So I appreciate you breaking that down. And I want to continue this thread of, I guess, advice, because that's somewhat advice, right? And I feel like you have a wealth of knowledge. Maybe share some more. What other advice would you say to budding entrepreneurs and product builders who are looking to build Web3 fintech solutions to kind of fill out that landscape? You know, yeah, what's your advice? I'm very curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think this probably kind of alludes to my background as well, but writing. So, you know, with the previous publication that I built, at this point, I've written over 200 public and private pieces and articles, hundreds and thousands of words. And I've just found that the best form factor for clear thought is in writing. And so for any kind of Web3 founder looking to get into this space, is we need to think clearly because it's so early, it requires navigation. You're building new things, you're innovating in different ways that perhaps you thought you wouldn't have to if you're building a classic B2B SaaS company in the Web2 world. And to succeed requires extremely clear thinking. It would be a folly to rely on the wealth of classic startup literature that we've seen in kind of, you know, decades past. You need to build new playbooks. And for that, it requires clear thinking. So that would be my advice.
Well, first of all, I think you're a phenomenal writer. And I think that writing well also lends to clear thinking, as you've so eloquently said in your answer. And so, yeah, I want to second that. It's phenomenal advice. I want to switch gears a little bit because I know that you have some unique insights on this. Circle recently made the decision to file an IPO. And that for me, and I believe for you as well, is a huge step in the right direction for crypto. You know, Coinbase made waves in the traditional markets for doing something similar. I wonder what your opinions are on the most recent filing for the IPO and what that means for payments and fintech Web3 startups.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great news to, you know, that Circle's finally looking to IPO, go public. I know they tried to do a SPAC previously, but that didn't quite work out. And so I think, you know, this was definitely, you know, coming at some point. I think what this means for, you know, Web3 payments, Web3 fintech is it's phenomenal news, right? Because it sends a very strong signal to VCs that, look, this is a space that should be getting more attention in terms of venture funding. I think it will attract more talented builders and founders into the space so they can also build more breakthrough products. But I also think it opens the, you know, proverbial floodgates for more innovation within stablecoins as a technology. I think a common misconception that I see today is, you know, innovation in stablecoins started and kind of ends with Circle, which just isn't true. You're seeing more people, for example, more financialization happen with this tech. For example, people splitting the yields on the deposits of the fiat funds, people who are staking stablecoins. And so I think what this kind of does is a ton more innovation is available and left over in this kind of category. And so I think at least in a local sense, we'll see more happen there. I think in a more global sense, you know, Web3 fintech as a category will certainly get more attention because I would say in some ways Circle is, you know, the bastion, the leader of this category. And it's great to finally see one of our own go public, I suppose.
Indeed, indeed. I wish them a successful filing because, as you say, it's going to be a phenomenal step forward for crypto. So following on from this theme of exciting developments as we come into the final aspects of today's podcast, what other exciting developments, whether that be new projects or new EIPs or new whatever, you know, like you decide. What are some things that are getting you excited? And that could also be you personally. Like, what do you like? Maybe if there's something you're working on at Super that you could share some alpha with us on, that would also be pretty cool as well. But no pressure, of course. If yeah, whatever is interesting for you.
I think we have an announcement soon, so we'll definitely be sharing some alpha on Super and what we're building. We're building some fundamentally new things, and so. Definitely excited to share that soon, depending on this podcast goes out. But I think more broadly, kind of continuing the theme of Web3 fintech, developments combining open banking and crypto rails, I think, is very interesting. You know, the idea of being able to, instead of leveraging, say, these classic card networks like Visa, like MasterCard, to enable transactions between merchant and consumer, you're actually now moving money through, you know, open banking, crypto rails to result in even lower fees for the merchant. And so I'm very, very excited about that. Just because, you know, if done correctly, what this means is you see a lowering of transaction fees, you see more increased global liquidity in commerce. And, you know, as Stripe likes to say, the resultant force of that is increasing the GDP of the internet. So I think fundamentally, open banking, crypto rails in a bid to push transaction fees even lower for merchants and consumers is a phenomenal development that I'm watching very closely these days.
Exciting, exciting. And I hope to see that category flourish. This is the final question. And I love asking this question because it gets people to think. So here it is. When I say the words most successful Web3 founder, you're probably thinking about someone in your head. If you were sat in front of them right now, what is the one question you'd ask them, whether it be about product, growth, hiring, operations, whatever you want for your company or just for your journey in Web3 as a builder?
What a question. Yeah, I think for me, and it's one I look up to a lot, just because I think respect is thinking. He actually passed away somewhat recently, is a fellow by the name of D Hawk. He was one of the early pioneers of kind of Visa and kind of credit cards. And the organization that he's built has just been phenomenally successful. And so I you know, would definitely want to talk to him. I think the question I would ask him is, you know, how would you, using the lessons you've learned from Visa, you know, what would be your prescription in, at least from the sense of distribution, in enabling faster growth in crypto as a peer method? It's certainly a broad question. I'm sure D would be able to navigate it successfully. But I think for me, it strikes at, you know, the fundamental achievement that he accomplished in enabling such fast and viral growth of credit cards. And so I'd say, look, hey, D, you know, how can you bring some of that magic to crypto? How would you do it? And so that's what I'd ask him.
Okay. Well, this is quite funny because normally what I would end with and say after someone shares their thoughts there, I was like, maybe one day we'll get that person on and we'll ask that question. But unfortunately, he's not around with us. That was a phenomenal answer. That was amazing. And hopefully we can get someone close to him who can get you that answer. Bezola, it's been my absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. You're a phenomenal thinker, phenomenal writer, phenomenal podcast guest. Thank you so much for being here. And I look forward to doing many more of these into the future. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Abel, for having me. It's been a pleasure.